Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you wildlife facts, conservation updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. This week's episode is part two of our chat about UK bird crime. This time I chat with birder and ornithologist Jack Badhams. Before getting into the chat about bird crime though, I spoke with Jack about the world of bird ringing, his favourite birds of swifts and corvids, and how many birds have so far been ticked off Jack's to-see list. Then of course we did move on to bird crime. I asked Jack what the main issues are and what the next steps are to challenging and putting a stop to something that is so damaging to bird populations. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show.
I will. This is how I'm going to start it. I do this weird thing where when I've got an interview with someone or a chat with someone, about half an hour, 45 minutes before, I sing their name because I'm bad with names and I forget who I'm talking to. Turns out your name, Jack, goes with any song.
Does it?
I was getting ready and then I went, I'm bad. Jack Badham, yeah. Boom, 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 and any song. I mean, name a song and try it. It just, you can do the Muppets.
Oh, yeah.
Da, 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 da.
Jack, yeah, Badham. That works. I mean, obviously I had no say in it, but I do like my last name.
It's a very good last name.
It's good. I think I lucked out on the last name draw.
I think it's good. It worked. And like I said, I was walking around the house. My girlfriend was like, what are you singing? I was like, just getting Jack's name in my head. But that's how we're starting the show. So,
okay, great.
Jack Badhams, Welcome to Into the Wild. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And yeah, absolute pleasure to meet you and talk to you. So to get the listeners up to speed, would you like to tell us who you are and what is it you do?
Where to start? So I've been interested in wildlife and in particular birds for a very long time. Birds have always been my main thing. And I was lucky enough to have had that passion from a very, very young age and been able to follow it through into kind of adult life. So I started bird ringing quite early for the BTO, then went away and did university and all that stuff. And then spent a few years as an expedition scientist.
Oh, wow.
With a group of people called Operation Wallacea, when I was lucky to travel to some of the most remote and unexplored, really, parts of the world and do some ornithology work there, some bird-related science work there. And then I've since got into the world of kind of natural history television.
That's really cool.
So that's probably my life so far, really.
And we should probably talk about this quite early on. Recently on Twitter, you and I had a very, very calm and polite...
A spat. It was a Twitter spat. It was social media drama is what it was.
I tweeted...
This close to dropping a diss track.
I'd had a beer and I was overconfident. And I tweeted... Someone said, like, what's your controversial wildlife opinion? And I said, I don't find birds that interesting. And... You know, I said this to Indy, there's so many birders, there's more birders on this planet than there are birds, and it feels like there is. There's like 40 to one bird. So what, right, how are we going to settle this on here?
Well, so I think the thing that lets birds down is a lot of the time the people who like birds. It's not the birds themselves. So I, as a birder myself, generally the one group of people I can't stand are birders.
Yeah.
Most of them, to be fair, are lovely. But there's just that, especially when you get to autumn and migration season and all that stuff. I mean, I love a lancelotted warbler as much as the next guy. But if I have to scroll through Twitter and see... hundreds of pictures of the same one that's landed in a bit of scrub in Shetland and is slowly like having the life disappear out of it as it's being chased around this little patch of headland. But birds themselves are the most exquisite creatures going. Yeah. I think they're just extraordinary and they're so diverse and they're so ancient. So that's what I like about birds is that they are a mix of beauty. But there's something so primeval about them. And you only need to look at a bird's legs and you can see that they're dinosaurs.
Now that I'll go with. That yeah. I'll go with. I mean, you can see that, and it's very clear, especially when you look at real ancient birds, like, you know, kind of the larger ones as well. You can really see it. It's so clear. And
I mean, you just need to look at a chicken. Look at a chicken's leg. Look at a chicken's eye. Look at the way it's moving, if it's moving through the grass and looking for insects or something. And you can see that deep within that DNA, there's a velociraptor in there.
Somewhere.
Somewhere.
It's like looking for the wolf in a pug.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah. We've not quite analyzed birds that much, I don't
think.
That's
true. That's true. But that's interesting what you said about it's birders. And we'll obviously be careful the way we say this, because like you said, there's many a good. But I'm the same with vegans, because I'm vegan. And if it's one group of people I can't stand the most, it's other vegans. So
I think
sometimes the group you're in.
Definitely. And it doesn't do... I think maybe the reason we don't like those people who are too far to the extremes is because it doesn't do our interest or any favours.
Yeah.
Because they're just, you know, they're just too much. They're twitchers. Just stop it. Just, I'm a big birder, and I've got a list of every bird that I've seen.
How many's that?
It's not anywhere near where it should be. But it's like 800 and something around the world.
Yeah, that's quite a lot.
But there are like, I think there's now 11,000 species on Earth.
Where should it be for you?
I want to clock out at about half of that. Well, the thing is, I did. That's what I always used to say. But now I'm less because of everything that's going on and because of climate awareness, I'm less interested in traveling around the world. I mean, I'm not less interested, but I feel more strongly about not doing it or doing it more responsibly. So I don't know whether I'll ever get to that. But originally, I wanted to clock out of life on around 5,000 birds, which is half the world's birds.
I mean, you're a very young man.
Yeah, I am. But there's a lot of birds, and most of them are quite hard to find. They don't make themselves easy.
Is that true? Most birds are hard to find.
I don't know. Oh, what percentage are hard? The thing is, when you go to... So I, on one of my expeditions, I went to Indonesia. I went to Sulawesi, which is one of the most extraordinary... After Madagascar, it's got the second most number of species that are only found on that in that area.
Oh,
endemic
wow.
Species. So I went there and I spent 2 months in the jungle, literally living in a hammock and going out every single day and doing transects and mapping all the species that we found in there. My bird list of species that I'd seen at the end of that 2 months in the jungle is I'd added about 80 species.
Okay.
Now, I have done 24 hours birding in Norfolk in the UK and seen 127 species in 24 hours. So when you go to the jungle, when I say are birds hard to find, when you go to the jungle, it's not like it is in Africa, where you see it on TV and you see all the animals, and then you go there and you're like, holy shit, they're everywhere. I can see them. When you go to the jungle, you can hear them all, but you can't see them at all. So it takes
a dense forest.
Yeah, you can't see kind of most of the time, you can't see 5-10 meters in front of your face. So being able to see 40-50 meters up into the canopy is impossible. So it's a bit of a tricky thing to rack up that many species of birds. And some people are, of course, obsessed by it. And some people have seen 9,000 species of birds, which is almost all of them.
There's got to be a bit of a copy-paste job there, isn't it?
And the thing is, some people are dead, but their species list still keeps going up because they're splitting so many species of birds now because of DNA and genetics. They're dead, but they're still in like the top 10 list of birders worldwide because they keep growing
now.
Seriously. Because they saw let's just say an olive-backed sunbird on one island in Indonesia, and then they also recorded that they saw it in another island, and now in let's say 2016 those two species have been split. So then someone who's, you know, looking after their list since they're dead can add that species in, and they've got an extra one.
See, that shouldn't be allowed. I'm getting involved now. Because they didn't know they were looking for another species, so it shouldn't count.
I agree. I think what some people are willing to tick on their lists as well is also a really interesting... Some people will tick if they've just heard the bird, which is really controversial.
If that's the case, I'm up to a good 200.
I've got a mate who won't tick a bird on his list unless he's seen its eye, because that's when he feels like he's really connected with the bird, which is... So there's a complete breadth of, you know... It's mad.
I won't tick it off unless I've had a gin and tonic with the bird. God, this is a what an insight into birders and stuff. This is incredible.
It is madness.
So you are an ornithologist. Now, what does that mean?
So ornithologist is basically the branch of science that is focused on birds. I don't know exactly where, I used to know where it came from, the word, and what it was derived from, but I can't remember now. But it's basically the science of birds in general.
And you're also, you mentioned you started your early career as bird ringing. Now, what does that involve?
So bird ringing is basically the fitting of wild birds with little metal rings on their legs. And it's been the main way of studying species for now a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. But the original idea behind it is, if we see birds in the wild, how can we work out them as individuals? How can we realize that bird that we saw yesterday is the same bird that we're seeing today?
Yeah.
And when you can do that, when you can work out that a bird is an individual, you can start learning a lot about it. So you can start learning how long it lives, for example. You can start learning where they travel to. So before bird ringing, we knew that we had swallows in the UK in spring and summer.
Yeah.
But then they disappeared in winter. We knew that swallows were down in Africa in winter, but we didn't know that they were the same swallows. So that's why you get all those fantastic, there's medieval drawings of swallows diving into ponds and sleeping over winter, because people used to think that that's where they went. I'm sure it's in ancient Greece, it might be Aristotle, had this idea that red starts morphed into robins during the spring and winter, because they look very, very similar. So they morph one to the other. So before we could actually work out these birds as individuals, we didn't know any of this kind of stuff. So basically, we then had to work out how to mark these birds. Now, it's a long way around to get to the story of bird ringing, but I have to tell the story. So one of the first ways that we realized you could mark birds as individuals and that would lead to our understanding of migration comes from Germany. Mm. When white storks would turn up every year and breed on the houses in Germany, many people, you know that the storks will build massive nests on chimneys and stuff like that. And one stork turned up with a spear right through its neck. And because of traveling around the world and all this kind of stuff, people realized that spear was of African design, and that somebody in Africa had thrown a spear at that stork, trying to kill it, trying to hunt it. It had gone straight through its neck. The stork had survived and then flown all the way to Germany in the spring to breed.
Oh my God.
And people were like, hold on. That means that because of that mark, that thing that's on that bird, that has come from Germany. And that was really one of the first times that people connected the dots of where these birds came from. And they gave it there's a German name. It's called like the Pfeilstork, which means the arrow stork, because there's not just been one. There's been, the first one is stuffed and it's in a museum somewhere, but there's been about 8 of these storks that have turned up in Europe with African spears through them. So then the idea came, well, can we fix something to a bird that's a little less intrusive? Spear straight through.
I don't think this is the way we need to go.
Yeah. Like, good idea, but maybe we can refine it a little bit.
Let's evolve this.
So then what we now do, of course, is we fix little metal rings to their legs. And it's no different to the bird than it is for us wearing a bracelet or a wristwatch. You know, these are tiny, very lightweight rings. And they have a unique number on them, a unique code that tells you that once it's fitted to that bird, stays with it for the rest of its life. So if I was to catch a blue tit in my garden, I'd fit it with a unique ring number. And then if I catch it in 5 years' time, I know it's the same bird, I know how old it is. Or if that flies to somebody else's garden and they catch it, then they know it's my bird and we can work out where they've gone. So ringing has taught us so much about how long birds live, where they move, because we're able to get to know them as individuals.
That's amazing. And I guess, how easy is this to do? Because like you said, if we use a bird, for an example, as a blue tit, which is, you know, a small bird, but then I'm guessing this is done throughout nearly all bird species that we are able to do this too. How difficult is this when you get to larger, let's say, bird of prey species?
So within birds of prey, you've obviously got a great range of sizes. So I've caught sparrowhawks and kestrels and things in the UK using the same nets that we're catching general smaller birds in. I should say, actually, that when we're out bird ringing, the way we catch birds, the best way to catch birds, is using something called a mist net, which is basically, imagine a badminton net, a net strung between two poles with a very, very fine mesh that the birds can't see. In fact, humans can't see it. I've been caught in, I've walked into them multiple times, and people walk into them all the time. It's a really fine mesh that when it's set in shadow or against vegetation becomes difficult to see. So you set your net up, the birds are moving through the vegetation, they can't see it, they fly into the net, they get caught. So you can catch sparrowhawks and kestrels and things in that kind of net. You can then get bigger gauge nets that are stronger, and you can catch peregrine falcons, you can catch buzzards. But then, obviously, when you get to larger species, we're talking eagles, things like that, most of the ringing of those is done in the nest. So you're going up, you're fitting the rings to them when they're very, very small, when they can't really hurt you that much. And then they carry that for the rest of their life. And that's also a great chance to fit satellite tags and all this amazing stuff that we can fit to them nowadays. But that's all using the skills of ringing. There is, though, an incredible thing that I read about people, how people catch white-tailed eagles in somewhere in Scandinavia, I think potentially Norway. But I remember reading about it a few years ago, where to catch white-tailed eagles, they would bait an area with food and the eagles would come down. And this was after breeding season, when they all kind of, they can band together in quite large groups. And they're coming down and they're feeding on all this meat and they're bickering and they're fighting and all that kind of stuff. So you get them used to an area. But in that area, you've dug a little... almost like a little tiny shed, like a little hide into the ground. And the eye level of it, if you're stood in it, you're kind of submerged and you've got a little slit that you can look out of. So it's like a submerged hide.
Okay.
And you go in it under the cover of darkness and all the meat's around, and then the white-tailed eagles start coming in and they're feeding on all the meat and they start bickering and they start doing what white-tailed eagles do. And you literally are in this hide and you stick your hand out, you grab an adult fledged white-tailed eagle by its leg, pull it into the hide, tie it up, put it in a bag, stuff it in the corner. And because the eagles are just so preoccupied with fighting each other, they've not realized that an eagle's disappeared. So then you can stick your hand out and grab another one and pull it in. And that's how you can catch and ring adult eagles. But there's all sorts of ways. There's all sorts of imaginative ways of catching birds if you want to go for something. In general, it's mist nets for smaller songbirds and various things, but there are all sorts of ways that you can catch birds to fit tags to them if you do really need to.
That way you just described got horrific quick. That started like, yeah, so there's a little shed, and then you punch the air and grab a bird.
Well, you just grab an eagle by its leg.
Yeah, that got less specific and technical the more...
Yeah, I remember reading about it and being like, this is the most incredible thing ever.
That's also a very Scandinavian thing to do.
Yeah, incredible.
It's very in tune with the nature going, just grab. So do you have a favourite type of bird or family of bird that you like to see?
Yeah, so my favourite bird. So actually, I've got two answers to this. So my favourite bird is a swift. Just like a common swift that we see in the UK, because it is absolutely extraordinary. And it's a bird of insane numbers, and it's a bird that it is really the epitome of what it means to be a bird. So a swift spends basically its entire life in the sky. So it only ever lands to breed, to lay eggs, to incubate those eggs and the chicks when they're younger. But it spends its entire life, other than that, completely in the sky. So a swift is flying around. It eats while it's flying, just like a swallow does, catching things on the wing. It drinks while it's flying by flying really low and scooping water up. It bathes while it's flying by flying really low and dunking its body in the water. They mate while they're flying, just by being very, very coordinated and kind of maneuvering on top of each other. And they sleep while they're flying. So they'll fly really high up into the sky and then just go to sleep and spiral around in big circles and wake up before they hit the ground and fly up.
The spiral's down.
Yeah, they just spiral around in big circles. But birds are really useful in that they can, they have very useful brains for this, because they can send half of their brain to sleep in one go. And that's why when you watch ducks asleep next to a pond, you will often see, this can be any pond in a city or whatever, you walk past a duck, you'll often see them sat next to the pond with their eye next to the water, closed, and their eye facing into the land, awake. And they are resting. They're resting half of their brain, but they're keeping one eye open in case they need to jump into the water really quick. But the water is where they feel safe. So they'll send half their brain to sleep and keep an eye on the land while the water, they're pretty comfortable that nothing's going to come and get them from there.
What a great skill.
Yeah, that would be so useful. You could get so much done.
I would have used that in several people's Edinburgh Fringe shows if I had that kind of ability.
So swifts, definitely. Really cool. And they're also, when you think of a baby bird that fledges, like a blackbird or something in your garden, the first ever flight it makes, it flutters out of its nest and it might get 2 or 3 feet and then it flops on the ground or in the nearest bush. But a swift, the first ever flight that a baby swift will make, so they nest in the eaves of houses, in little cracks and crevices in buildings or historically cliffs. And that swift will hatch in the summer, it'll get grown, it'll shuffle to the edge of that nest. And then it will drop out, and swifts, if they touch the ground, they can't take off. Because their wings are so swept back that they can't get the lift that they need. They're so scythe-shaped that they can't get that vertical lift, unless there's a really strong wind to kind of blow them up to take off. So if you find a swift on the floor and it's kind of okay, you have to go up to it, basically grab it, and chuck it up into the air so that it can get that wind underneath its wings and take off.
Find a swift on the floor, grabbing swifts.
But that does mean when you catch them. So I've only been very lucky to catch swifts a couple of times to ring them. But the best thing about releasing them is that you just grab them and lob them up into the sky. It's so cool. So a swift can't touch the ground. So a baby swift has to have a successful first flight, and it drops out of the eaves of its nest in its building and will carry on flying, and it won't land again until it reaches sexual maturity, and that's to lay an egg or to build its nest or whatever, and that can be 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
So that bird won't touch anything for 2 or 3 years time. It will just fly constantly in the sky. So they really are like bird 2.0. they're just
incredible
animal.
Yeah, presumably, and I might be wrong here, is it with the males, if they're really the only time they're landing is for nesting, do they split share the incubation, or is it just females? Or
so the males, I'm not sure about incubation, but the males certainly come in and feed the the chicks. So they are landing for those reasons.
Okay.
But they've got these incredibly short, they're just hyper evolved for life in the sky. So they've got these incredibly swept back wings. They've got these incredibly short legs, and their Latin name, Apus Apus, actually means no feet, because they were believed not to have any feet because people saw them flying all the time. But they've got these tiny feet with these really sharp claws for hanging onto vertical rock faces and things. But they're incredible. So they're my favorite bird. My favorite family of birds, though, isn't the swifts, because although I do like the swift, all the swifts are pretty similar. But crows, corvids, are my favorite family of birds, because they're just ridiculously smart. And when you start talking about jays, which are part of the corvid family, you get so many beautiful colors, not just our jay in the UK, which is pink and blue, but you get bright green ones. You get all sorts of different colors that are just incredible.
I get followed by crows. Sorry, I couldn't finish that sentence. I run a dog daycare company, which I think some of my listeners will know, at Hampstead Heath, and we do vegetable scatter feeds for the dogs, and therefore we get followed by one or two of the same crows in certain areas, because they just know, well, we'll just follow you and pick up what the dogs don't.
they are incredibly smart, and there was a university in America that did a study where they were catching crows and fitting rings to them, colouring, so that the colours, the rings that the crows had on them were brightly coloured, so that you didn't need to re-catch that bird again to read its ring number. You could just see from afar that's, you know, black and orange or whatever. But because the crows were so smart, they were going through this experience of being caught, but then they would remember the face of the person who'd done it.
Wow.
And then they'd mob them throughout. If they were walking around the campus, they would mob them. And then because crows are so social as well, is they'd get all the rest of the crows to mob them and would follow them around, screaming and swooping on them, until eventually all the scientists had to start wearing whenever they caught the crows, they had to start wearing, oh, it was a mask of an American president, and I can't remember which one, but they wore these they wore these caricature masks of an old American president, and whenever they caught the crows, that's what they wore, so that the crows wouldn't recognize that it was a poor person. And so that you could go about your actual university life without being mobbed in the sky by crows.
I love how you said they had to go with a mask of an old American president. Like any other mask wouldn't have worked. It had to be a George Bush mask.
The crows would have seen right through it.
No success rate. That's hilarious. God, they gang up. I've seen them gang up on small dogs. Like, we've seen, like, dogs just running behind us, and then we'll turn around and, like, three or four crows are swooping down on them because we might have walked underneath a nest or something like that. And we're just like, oh, my God, is that little shih tzu all right?
There was an incredible video I came across in June, I think it was, which was a red kite that had been pinned down onto somebody's lawn by a whole gang of crows. And they were just... I love crows. They're so badass. And they've just pinned this red kite down and they were just hammering it. Anyway, the red kite managed to escape. But you would want a crow on your side in a fight. They're a good animal to know.
I've always said that.
Yeah. If I'm picking a dream lineup of animals to have my back, the crow is definitely in it. Because it's smart. It's going to fight dirty. It's not afraid of kicking sand in your eyes. It's, you know, a crow is the one that you'd want, I think.
What's the collective name for crows? Do you know?
So it's a murder of crows.
The murder of crows. Just getting more and more badass, isn't it?
The cognition that they have, and the more we learn about how smart all animals are, really, because for too long we've underestimated the intelligence of animals. But crows have an extraordinary intelligence, up there with kind of 6-7 year old children.
Yeah.
And they've been shown, they're one of the only animals that we know has a concept of imagination, in that they can be faced with a scenario. So what they tend to do with crows is, particularly New Caledonian crows, which are from the island of New Caledonia, and they're always the ones that are used for these kind of studies. What you do is you set lots of challenges for them. And the simplest challenge to do is, or one of the simplest ones for crows, is you have a see-through tube, a see-through cylinder, and you put a little treat in it, but it's floating on some water. But the water's maybe only halfway up this cylinder. Okay. And the crow can't reach its beak in to actually get out the maggot or whatever it is that's floating in there. But also within its enclosure, you've got stones. And the crow knows that it needs to go over to these stones. And if it drops them into the cylinder, the water level will raise high enough for it to get the thing. So the crow, that's something that quite easily they can work out, that they need to raise the water level so they can reach it. So then what you do is you take those stones and you go, okay, crow, that's very smart, but I'm going to take these stones and I'm going to lock them away inside another puzzle. So imagine now you've got a box that's covered on all sides except one. And that one side has got kind of bars on it. So the crow can now see the stones within this box, but it can't reach them.
Mm.
Elsewhere in its aviary, the scientist will then put a little strip of metal wire. And what the crows will then do is they'll go, right, okay, so the food's in that cylinder that I can see through, but I know I can't reach it because the water level's too low. I know I need the stones, but I can't get the stones because they're in this box. Then it goes over to the wire. It takes the wire. It grabs it in its beak. Oh, sorry. It puts it on the floor, puts its foot on it, grabs the end of the wire with its beak, twists it into a hook, will then pick it up in its beak, wander over to the box, hook the stones out with that hook that it's just created, walk over to the thing, drop it in, the water level raises, it gets its treat. And then what you can do is you can take that metal wire and hide that inside another puzzle, and then you can take the key to that puzzle and hide it inside another puzzle. So what they've been able to show is that not only can crows work out a quite complex situation, but they've also got this imagination capability where they can look at something and they can see it in steps, and they go, okay, I'm imagining myself getting to the end point, but to get to that end point, I need to do this, this, and this. So they really are astonishingly clever.
If I ever go in an escape room, I'm taking a crow. I'm not going with any friends. I'm taking one crow.
That would be great, yeah. That's good.
I'd be out of there like that.
15 minutes, that's the fastest anyone's ever done it.
Just me and one crow. We spoke, so this episode we're also going to be, I guess, kind of recapping a bit about a topic that we spoke about fairly recently with Indy Green on Into the Wild, which was about bird crime. And this came up, well, for a number of reasons, as I'm sure you'll go into detail a little bit with. But one of them was being the RSPB released a report of bird crime from 2019 to 2020. And it was quite an astonishing report. And it's kickstarted a lot of media attention onto this as well. My question I wanted to ask you is, what are the main, I guess this is quite a broad question, but what are the main issues regarding bird crime in the UK?
Yeah, so obviously the last, I don't know, the last 4-5 years, I don't know how long it's been now, this issue has really kind of been pushed into the light. And I suppose it's very easy to approach this topic being very polarized from, I see it, you know, that it's everything from the people staunchly defending the fact that bird crime isn't happening from the shooting community, and it's people saying that they want all shooting to end and that all shooters are bad and all that kind of stuff. I like to think that I'm somewhere in the middle on this whole debate, but we can't hide from the fact that bird crime is happening, and everybody knows that it's happening, and it's an embarrassment that it's still happening. And we've spoke about ringing, and those skills that we've got from bird ringing and being able to now fit satellite trackers too, that's the key, is we've been able to fit these satellite trackers to hen harriers, to golden eagles, to white-tailed eagles, because actually witnessing bird crime or finding any proof of bird crime is incredibly difficult, because a lot of the time this is happening in very sparsely populated areas, very remote areas, and it's a complete chance occurrence that you would witness somebody doing this act. There are cases where it's been happened. There have been cases where, some that I can remember, where people have witnessed short-eared owls being shot by people. But that's incredibly, want of a better word, lucky a chance event that you would see that. But we now know through satellite tagging these birds and their mysterious disappearances, all within these certain hotspots. Now, where I'm from, which is the North Derbyshire area, I'm very close to the Peak District. And the Peak District is one of those hotspots. It's a black hole for birds of prey. They go in very often, they don't come out. Okay. And you can't hide that data. That data shows that there are these very particular spots where birds are dying suspiciously and not through natural circumstances. And we know it's because they're being illegally killed. So how do we fix it? Well, it's very difficult for us outside the fraternity that seems to be doing it. And I'm going to say the shooting fraternity, because in general, that's where it seems to come from. And once again, it's not everybody, but in general, that's where it seems to come from. But there is bird crime from, I know, in the kind of South Yorkshire area, there's a lot of pigeon races still going on. And I know of peregrines that have been poisoned and shot because of people who race pigeons, pigeon fanciers. So it's not just people from the shooting community, although we do know that that makes up a substantial part of it. But other people are killing raptors. But what can we do about it? Well, we particularly can't do that much actively. What we need is we need to keep up the pressure, because bird crime, I feel, is slowly starting to decrease. I can't see it. There's so much pressure, there's so much focus on it, that it's an embarrassment it's still happening, but it's not happening as much as it was. And I don't think it can happen as much as it was, because there is so much focus on it. And people within these, you know, communities where there are these bad apples that are doing bird crime would say, oh no, look, it's great. We're proving that we're sorting out our house or whatever. But I don't think we would be seeing that improvement if it wasn't for all the noise that has been made by various people. So we have to keep up the pressure, and we have to make it known that this isn't acceptable, and we have to keep shining a light on it, using the weight of scientific evidence that we've got to prove that this is a thing and say that this should be a thing of the past. And it's mental that we're still doing this in 2020, that hen harriers and white-tailed eagles are still being shot and poisoned. It's absolute madness. But what we also need is stronger deterrence. Yeah. We need stronger sentencing for people who are found guilty, and we need there to be some sort of repercussions for their employers, or if they are doing it on behalf of people.
Mm.
So I think, because another thing as well is there's often, I often see thrown around is, well, people must know who are doing, people must know who's out there killing birds of prey. But I genuinely don't think that there is a secret underground network of people within the shooting community that are all out there, you know, killing birds of prey. I was watching a program a couple of nights ago about Harold Shipman and how he killed, you know, loads of people, but hospital staff didn't know that.
Yeah.
So people can get away with these, people can get away with things. So yeah. I think there probably are just these people out there that are acting either on their own or within these small groups. But I certainly don't think it's as easy as saying, well, the shooting community know exactly who's out there shooting all these raptors. But if somebody is found to be trapping a goshawk and bludgeoning it to death, or poisoning buzzards or whatever, there should be repercussions, not just on them, I don't think, but on the wider estate or whatever has employed them, because that's the reason they're doing it. They're doing it because of the interests of whoever they've been employed by, in the case of shooters, not in the case of pigeon fanciers who are just doing it of their own volition.
And I think that comes into the pressure build as well, because it's okay for one side, obviously, people that are concerned about this to say, let's put the pressure on and let's see it. Okay, it might have hit a steady number now because of the amount of pressure, but the more pressure, that number will go down. But also, if the industry itself is going to be penalized for people within that industry, if it happens, then they're going to naturally want to put that added pressure on as well to manage their estates better, to make sure it's not happening. Therefore, the numbers will drop even lower.
And I think the... So I, on Twitter, became very aware a few years ago that my... And it was around this topic. It was around the raptor persecution topic. And I became very aware that my social media bubble was very heavily the anti-shooting, anti-whatever brigade. And I didn't like that. So I found people within that shooting community who had tweets and posts and opinions that I kind of respected, and I followed them as well. And that has been really important to me, because it's shown that there are a lot of very forward-thinking people out there that are within that shooting community that I so often see demonized. And I don't want to see an end to shooting. I want to see better regulation of it. I don't particularly agree with driven grouse shooting, but I think if you're going to eat meat, it's often the best meat that you can eat.
Yeah.
And I'd love to think that we could turn, for example, the Peak District, which is my kind of, you know, beloved place. I would love to think that we could move away from driven grouse moors and create these incredibly biodiverse habitats that support such a wealth of life that you go out there and you shoot maybe a couple of grouse. Maybe we've even got a population, a strong enough population of black grouse that they're on the shooting list.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you've done some fantastic conversations about trophy hunting. And we know that hunting and shooting can have a really positive benefit. Mm-hmm. So I'm certainly not one of those people that wants to ban it completely.
Absolutely.
And there are some fantastic people in the field sports community, or whatever you want to call them. And I do see more and more people now standing up and calling out the behavior. If, let's say, a goshawk is a video, the most recent one I think I can remember was a video of a goshawk that had been trapped and somebody going into the pen and killing it. And I saw a lot of backlash to that from people within the shooting community. So I think it's definitely moving in the right direction.
Mm.
And although perhaps the figureheads of each side of the debate never seem like they're getting on any common ground, if you dig a little bit below, you can find some people on Twitter, on social media, having some really interesting, positive discussions about not only raptor persecution and how we can stamp it out, but also land use and field sports and how it can positively marry up with conservation. So it is an incredibly nuanced topic. And obviously on social media, all nuance gets lost. but I do find it fascinating. But going back to your original point, bird crime, it just needs to end. It's just madness that it's still going on.
Yeah, and I think you raise a brilliant point there, because when we talk about hunting, okay, we're aware there's a badger cull and fox hunting in this country. I don't really think we're aware of other types of hunting, illegal hunting, that is taking place. But I agree with the point that you're saying there. And like you mentioned, with a lot of the trophy hunting chats that we've had, it's trying to be more nuanced, but also trying to put that emotion aside, going, okay, I might not agree with it, but not everyone can share this view. So I have to work, you have to collaborate together in order to strive for better practices. Like you said, from not just the hunting itself, from a grouse hunting, for example, but the land management, because that's brilliant. What you said, imagine the biodiversity being so rich that you could hunt two or three types of bird on a land that's also supporting this massive network.
Yeah, and I think an example that's often quoted when it comes to thinking about our uplands in the UK is often we look at Scandinavia and how they tend to do things, Norway and Sweden, and the way that they don't really have this. We have this intense. It's the intensity, I think, of the driven grouse shooting that we seem to do here that's just altering vast swathes of habitat for this one species. And that's not the only species that benefit. There are some rare species that are doing very well out of intensively managed grouse moors. But those species are also doing well in the Norway and Swedish models, where you've got this habitat mosaic that just supports such a biodiversity. And if it's supporting those populations, then let's license hunting of the animals that live within it. I've got no problem with that. I think it's an excellent source of getting meat. You know, here at the where I'm living in Bristol, the Forest of Dean is very close, and I was there over the weekend, and there's so many boar in the Forest of Dean, which is great that we've got boar in there, but there is no natural predator of those boar.
Yeah.
So is having something like they have in America, where you can apply for a license to go out and shoot a deer or two or whatever every season. Something like that, I think, would get us closer to where our meat comes from people that eat meat, gets you outside, connects you with nature, and can have positive impacts on animal numbers or whatever. In the case of wild boar and deer that don't have these limiters of the top predators.
I guess one of my questions then was going to be, what are the next steps since the RSPB report and what we learned from over the last few months, or let's say the last year. Would you say that you believe, like personally for you, the next kind of step should be more of a collaboration with these estate management?
I think collaboration, we can't understate how powerful collaboration is. You can't downplay just how important it is to have people discussing things, because like I say, some of the discussions I've seen on Twitter from people in that kind of middle ground are fascinating, and to me they speak of a much more biodiverse future where hunting and shooting is still a thing, but we all benefit from such a richer biodiversity. So I think communication, absolutely, we've got to keep up the pressure. We've got to keep up the pressure until bird crime is gone completely. And I think we've that middle ground is going to be where the change happens. I do feel like it's only going one way. I think if I was a staunch shooter who was very to the far end of that spectrum, I think I would be worried about the future of it, because it does feel like the tide is on the side of, let's say, the anti-shooting brigade. But they're never gonna. We shouldn't. I don't think we should ever strive to get rid of shooting. As long as people eat meat, we shouldn't ever want to get rid of shooting.
And like,
if everybody turned vegan, great.
Yeah.
You know, we don't need to kill anything. But that's not going to happen.
No.
And the worst thing, it would be better for the planet if it happened, but that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But the worst thing is when I see meat eaters, heavy meat eaters that go to the shops and buy a packet of, the cheapest quality chicken or beef or whatever they can find, then saying how cruel shooting is.
Yeah. Because there's such a wire cross there.
Yeah. It's just, it's completely baffling. And shooting does, whether we like to admit it or not, it's there are people there that know what they're doing from a conservation perspective. Mm-hmm. And we have to collaborate with them. Collaboration will be the key going forward, as well as keeping up that pressure to stamp out the worst practices within that industry.
And my last question to you is our Into the Wild question. That is, if you could pass on one bit of advice to everyone on the planet regarding the natural world, what would it be?
It's going to be a very broad answer, but I think we just need so much more respect for it. Mm. I think we need, and you get that respect, I think, by learning our place in it, and just by our very existence, what we're doing to it in our day-to-day lives, that we're now in a moment in time where we have to seriously make changes if we want this world to continue in the way that we've been lucky to enjoy it so far. Yeah. And now is the time for us all to start making changes. To preserve this world that we've got, we have to be willing to learn as much about our own impacts on it to do something about it. And whether that's changing your diet, whether it's not going on holiday as much. And these are all things that are now out there, and now it can feel like you're getting bombarded by all the time, and it can feel a bit of an attack. You can feel like, you can feel under attack with your lifestyle choices. But the more you learn about the state that we're in, and the more that you respect the natural world and its systems and how we're affecting it, the more you realize that now is the time that we have to make those changes. Hmm. So I feel like I could finish on maybe a nice note about going out and looking at noticing the detail and all that kind of stuff. But now is the time for us to be making radical changes to our own lives, because we know that now that the issue isn't the fact that there's 7 billion people or 8 billion or whatever there is on the planet. We know that it's how we live.
Yeah.
And there are simple things that you can do to affect that. So I think that maybe.
And that's the full stop.
And that's the full stop. It's a bit hardcore though.
Well, Jack, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat to you today. Thank you so much for your insights on birds and bird crime as well. It's been a pleasure to chat to you. And I wish you all the best with your autumn watch. You've got 6 days before go live.
Yeah. Yeah, 2 weeks, so not long now.
So good luck with everything and that, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Well, thank you.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects of work Jack is working on, you can do so on Instagram at JABadams or on Twitter at JackBadams. Don't forget you can get in touch with me at intothewildpod@gmail.com or on social media at intothewildpod on Twitter and intothewildpodcast on Instagram. Whether you just want to say hello or share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you want to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.